Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today we have a roundtable discussion on core JavaScript concepts. This arises out of a previous discussion I had with Elijah Manner and Ward Bell, and I believe John Papa was in that, possibly John Galloway, and we said we should come back and really discuss JavaScript core concepts. So today I have my sometimes co-host John Galloway. John, how are you?
I'm doing great. We've got Build next week, and I've been working till 3 a.m. every day, so I'm a little slap happy, but I'm very excited.
I don't even know what to say to that. That's just terrific. And we've got Ward Bell on the panel.
I'm slap happy, and I have no excuse for being slap happy.
Ward is from Idea Blade and famous in MVP circles for his snappy dressing. Elijah Manner, who is a front-end web developer for Dave Ramsey and a world-renowned JavaScript expert. Elijah, thank you for joining us. And I'm looking forward to talking about JavaScript core concepts. And Ward kicked things off just before we began by asking, what is a concept? Do we mean coding techniques, architecture, patterns, practices, all of the above? What exactly do we mean by a concept? And what is lending it its urgency today? Elijah?
Yeah, I think in JavaScript, definitely more today than the past several years, is pretty much everyone's kind of writing some of it in one aspect or another. It's just becoming more and more a thing. Front-end architectures for JavaScript are very much a thing. New architecture patterns and libraries are coming up all the time. And in this day and age, you just kind of need to know JavaScript. And I guess something good to talk about in this particular podcast is what things should we know about? What are some gotchas that we need to be watching out for? How is JavaScript different than maybe C# or Java? Because that's just a very common thing that you'll get back-end developers coming to the front end and making a lot of common mistakes. We could bring that up and just lots of other things.
Let me add one other from the other side, which is you've got folks who want to know the difference between Java and JavaScript. And I liked your analogy that it's the relationship between car and carpet. I thought that was good. But then you've got the other side of folks who've gotten so used to working in jQuery and other frameworks that they perhaps don't have the grounding or the experience with JavaScript per se. And I would love for us to talk a little bit about how important is it today to really understand in a very solid way JavaScript.
Yeah, that's kind of tricky because a lot of the developers first come to the front end by writing jQuery code, which we all know is JavaScript, but sometimes developers don't realize that when they're a beginner. And so, you know, they'll find a cool snippet on a website that does something that they need with jQuery, so they slap it on their page and it works and they're like, yay. But eventually, the more and more you do that, the more and more dangerous it becomes, and they run into situations where they just don't understand that, hey, they are writing JavaScript and they can't just treat it as they've treated, you know, the backend languages. And so that's where having a good foundation of the JavaScript language is really important. But the nice thing, it's a two-edged sword. Like, the good thing is it's really easy to pick up jQuery just the way it's architected. And the really bad thing is some people never go much further. But it's good because designers could use it and not feel like they have to get too programmy. But then people who are really good at programming could actually excel with that as long as they, you know, do the due diligence and learn JavaScript appropriately.
Elijah, one of the things that I want to make sure that we get to today are three concepts that I think trip up a lot of JavaScript programmers, especially intermediate JavaScript programmers, the kind of folks you're talking about who maybe came through a framework and didn't get that very, very solid foundation. So those three are closure and prototypes and prototype inheritance and functions as objects. Elijah, you want to tackle any of those?
Sure. Yeah. You mentioned, you know, objects, and JavaScript is a functional language in that you could treat functions as an object, which is actually kind of different than maybe languages backend developers are used to. So it's a very powerful technique because you could have a function and pass it into other functions and do a bunch of cool stuff like that. Which is very powerful. You'll see other libraries, like underscore or Lodash that kind of heavily utilize that mentality of passing functions around. So that's a very powerful thing. And you could use functions in an interesting way, where you could create these things called closures. And you mentioned that as one of the things you want to talk about. And one of the cool things that a lot of people don't realize, at least they're coming to JavaScript, is when you create a closure, it basically creates a type of privacy for you. So when I first learned JavaScript, I didn't realize that you could have public and private properties and public and private methods, but you can. It's just a little more advanced concept. But that's where you would create a closure, which is essentially each function has its own kind of private data that you could kind of house in there and that can't get out, which is really kind of cool. But a concept you kind of need to know for all those things is that the scope is completely different in JavaScript, where kind of in C# and Java land, if you had a variable, you declared a variable inside of like an if statement with curly braces, that would be called a block scope. But in JavaScript, block scopes, variables aren't contained within a block scope. It's only contained within a function scope. And so that's a pretty big difference between the two languages. And that's kind of where the closures come in, because the memory stays with inside the function. So if you're coming at it from a C# or Java perspective and you don't understand that functions, you know, can be passed around, you don't understand that the scope is within a function, you can run into some strange problems. Because in C# land, I was always taught, you know, only declare variables right before you need it, which seems pretty reasonable. But when I wrote VB back in the day, that kind of dates me, VB6, I was always told to dim all my variables at the top of the function or procedure I was in. So in JavaScript land, you almost want to follow the VB6 rules, just because all of the variables are within the whole function anyway, so you might as well declare them at the top so it makes sense when you read the code as a developer. So in your head, you could kind of figure out what's going on. So those are some things to think about. Ward, do you have anything to add to that particular topic?
Well, particularly if you're coming from a Java or a C, any curly braced type language, you're going along and you say, hey, this ain't so bad. This just looks like what I write. And until you discover, because of the thing that you're talking about, that that the variables aren't really lexically there. They're getting moved around behind the scenes, that you say, whoa. The other telltale sign, and I think that something that you don't get right away, but then you realize the power of it, is that you start seeing functions declared within functions declared within functions. That's something you don't see in other languages. And as soon as you see that, you know you're not in Kansas anymore.
There's the nice thing about the syntax being similar to, I mean, C-based languages. And so C# and Java, and, you know, their developers are like, oh, I know this, I can write a function. And I think also there was a temptation, especially early on, because JavaScript was – people weren't writing unobtrusive JavaScript. They were writing on click events, right? And so the easiest thing to do there was just write a function and just, yeah, so what, I'm pulling stuff from global scope. It's just a scripting language. And you didn't really kind of think about architecting something real. And also didn't, I had a kind of an aha moment when, I'm not sure if you'd agree with this, Elijah, but a developer who was a lot better at front-end programming than I was told me that I should think of JavaScript more as Lisp. You know, it's like Lisp in C syntax, but it's not like the fundamentals are all pretty significantly different.
Yeah, Lisp is a pure functional language, and I think that's a helpful paradigm for someone who's not familiar with a functional language, because like, oh wow, I can do things like that. Now, obviously, JavaScript's not pure functional. You can mutate objects and things like that, but I think it's a good relation. It at least opens up their mind to, hey, I could do things differently than I have before, even though the syntax looks the same.
Mm-hmm. And not only that you can, but also that there's all these kind of surprises that happen, like variable hoisting. I remember seeing a presentation you did showing some things where, you know, there's that and scope and things just kind of change in ways that if you kind of just say, I'm just going to write some C# code and figure it'll work about the same, there's a few little surprises for you.
Yeah, it's a little tricky because there are several ways to declare a function. There's function statements and there's function expressions. And depending on how you declare it, they'll hoist it differently. And that can be a problem because sometimes you're trying to call some function and you're like, hey, it's not available. It should be available. It was available over here. And it just becomes kind of very confusing if you don't kind of dig in a little bit and understand those things. Because, you know, back in time when JavaScript was written, it was kind of made so it's really easy to use. And one of the downfalls of it is it's so easy to use that it does some of these magic things that you don't really want to happen as a professional developer. Like that's what you do day in and day out. But it's really great for someone just picking it up.
Sorry, you mentioned hoisting. I just want to make sure that you define that really briefly.
Yeah, so it kind of goes back to what I was talking about with declaring your variables at the top of your function, since it's a functional language. And so if you don't declare your variables at the top of the function, JavaScript's going to really do it for you anyway, even if you declare your function, your variables inside of an if statement or a for loop. JavaScript's going to go ahead and say, oh, you thought you meant to declare it right there, but I'm going to hoist it up to the very top of the function because variables are scoped to the whole function. And so it kind of does that for you, which is why, you know, tools like JSHint and JSLint encourage you to declare your variables at the top because it'll do it anyway. Now, the interesting thing is functions behave a little bit differently in the hoisting rules. Now, if you declare a function with a function expression syntax, so like var, you know, my method equals function curly brace, then it will follow the same rules as a normal variable hoist, where it'll keep the declaration, it'll keep the assignment in the same place, but it'll declare it at whatever higher level scope. Now, if you used a function statement, then it actually hoists both the assignment and the declaration all the way up to the very top of the whatever area you happen to be in. And so it could be a little confusing.
Well, I wasn't confused, but now I am. It gets even more confusing when you start to treat functions as objects. And the two things that come up then right away are trying to create private members and also what the this object or this, how do you refer to it in JavaScript? Not as a pointer, the this thing refers to.
Sometimes you refer it to as the this implicit parameter because it's something that's passed into a function that you didn't really pass manually, but it's implicitly there. It's kind of a long description, but it's really hard to talk about when you are pointing to it. This thing right here is this.
You know, that's...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry,
go ahead, John.
That's an example. You know, we were saying before, like, a lot of developers start with jQuery and then move into JavaScript. And, you know, for a lot of people, jQuery is just an abstraction over the DOM. It's basically like it fixes broken or different things about the DOM. But that's another thing that jQuery does for you, right, is that it removes the need to say that equals this and you know, scope locally, like control the scope of this within your functions.
Yeah, it does some of that behind the scenes, but you'll find that the more you write JavaScript and want to reuse, you know, different objects that have methods that you know, spend a lot of time testing those, and you kind of want to reuse some of those methods as a callback to maybe an event listener, you know, like I'm going to grab a button and say on, click, and I want to pass it a method I have somewhere else that's in some object. You run into problems with that because what jQuery will do for you is when you actually click on the button and it evokes that method that you had beforehand, this implicit parameter on the other side when it actually invokes it is the actual DOM element button. It's not what you probably meant. You wanted this to be whatever object that was that had that method on it so that you could access other properties and things. And so to get around that, historically, there's ways you could do it in raw JavaScript, like you call the apply method or the call method or all these different methods that allow you to identify what the this implicit parameter is. But it became such a thing, and most people didn't know how to do that. So in jQuery 1.4, several years ago, they came out with the proxy method in jQuery. And so if you're wiring up an event handler, you could wrap the method that you really want to be invoked when the event happens and say $.proxy, give it the method, and then you tell it, by the way, when you invoke this method, I want this implicit parameter to be, you know, XYZ, whatever you want it to be. So the more advanced jQuery you do, that it still does become an issue that you want to control the this. But if you're writing pretty straight up jQuery and, you know, just putting little pieces in, you can kind of get away without having to know that concept, but it's definitely important to know as you use it more and more.
So I think we need to step back because I think we probably scared everybody and they're running for the hills. And the problem here is that for so long, anybody with, you know, who had touched HTML or something like that said, you know, curly braces, I can write JavaScript. And they never had to realize that it really wasn't and isn't the same language. And if you were to go after any language and try and explain what it is in terms of something that somebody thinks it should be, then you're going to get into this kind of rabbit hole discussion where you're just scaring everybody. So I think it's important to step back and just say, hey, you know what? JavaScript is a language. It has its rules. And for a long time, if you've just been dabbling a little and throwing something on the screen, you could pretend that you didn't have to learn it. that you could pretend that you could be lazy and you didn't really need to know it, and you could just wing it and you'd probably get by okay. And what we're saying here, and really I think the purpose of this conversation is that to say, okay, you know what? I'm actually going to program for a change. I'm not just going to throw some scripting in the HTML. I'm actually going to program for a change. So what do I have to do that I would do with any other language to learn how to use this language effectively as a programming language rather than a coat of paint that I slap on every once in a while? So let's just not worry too much about how peculiar JavaScript is relative to other curly brace languages and sort of focus on the things that I must know to be good at JavaScript. And then we don't have to scare everybody.
That's great, Ward. So what are some of those absolutely key things that if folks don't know and they want to be serious about JavaScript, they need to know? Let's identify those. And also, let's make some time to be sure to talk about how to go about learning those things. What are some good resources?
Yeah, I guess one place, since there's no real compile step that you might be used to in other languages, like if you're coming to JavaScript and you want to make sure you're kind of going on the right direction, then having some kind of a code quality tool is a very smart idea. And I kind of mentioned it in passing, but like JSHint or Lint or ESLint is a new thing. They all essentially do the same thing. It's a static analysis to figure out, hey, are you accidentally doing some of these things that we've already talked about? That I mentioned many of the things I mentioned that are kind of those scary things that Ward mentioned, and it is very scary. This tool will kind of catch many of those, which is nice because you're like, okay, now I get actually focus on building my application and not worrying that I did some little thing wrong. So one of the first places I would start, maybe not the first place, but a very important concept that I would highly encourage JavaScript developers, and it becomes very common these days, is to use an iffy. You might have heard of it, immediately invoked function expression. It's a crazy term, but the what you get from it is really good. It basically provides a kind of a protective barrier for you, so you could put all of your code inside of it and not worry about it conflicting with, you know, another person's code. So, you know, Ward's writing some nice little library and I'm writing a library and, you know, John and Jesse, we're all writing different libraries and we want them to work together. If we're protecting ourselves with the iffy, IIFE, then we don't have to worry so much about my code breaking your code and our clashing. It's sort of similar to namespace, but not really what you would get in a different language like a Java or C sharp. And so it's a very important concept because if you don't do something like that and you just have a bunch of code all in the global namespace, so anytime you declare a function, it's just globally accessible off the window. If you just have tons of those, then we could break each other. And then Chrome extensions or Firefox extensions could actually break your code. I ran into a case where I was using a pretty popular tool. I'm not going to mention it, but it was a website and it broke one day and I was like, oh man. And I knew the developer, so I contacted him and it turned out it was one of my Chrome extensions that was conflicting with it. So in an enterprise situation, if you're writing a really big app that you want to run everywhere, you never know what extensions people are going to have. And so just using an iffy or something like that is very different from other languages in the way you write it.
Now, if you use an iffy, you've isolated your code out of the global namespace, but you don't have, if I understand it right, the ability to pass data or information from one object to another. So what do you do then? Do you use some form of global named object that sort of it sits in the global namespace but keeps you from having everything else in the global namespace, or is there a better way to do it?
Well, you could definitely pass things into the iffy down at the bottom where you actually invoke it. You could pass things into that, or you could actually return something from the iffy, and that's kind of where you could get the public and private properties that's exposed. Now, as for one iffy talking to another iffy, I would kind of go toward like a pub-sub model, like having messaging, like an event bus or something like that, because I like to have my components pretty separated and not have a tight dependency. And that's where either dependency injection comes in, which I think we'll probably eventually talk about, or we could have them communicate over, you know, publishing messages, subscribing to messages, and things like that. And that's kind of a good way for things to be very decoupled. Because, again, we could use all the many of the design patterns that we learned about for other languages, and we could utilize them in JavaScript too. And you'll see that more and more, like finite state machines, or, you know, my friend Jim Coward, he wrote a version in JavaScript. It's a very powerful concept, and we could have it too. How do you tend to do that, Ward?
Well, I want to sort of step back and sort of summarize what you're really saying is that, you know what, when you get to these things and you're not a script kiddie anymore, you start to bring in the patterns and the techniques that you learn to use in your professional life. And these include modularity, which is what the IFE is, a form of modularity that helps keep one module and its activity, private activities, private, not run into another. And then you start talking about, as Jesse was bringing up, how to communicate. And you're right, PubSub is one way, and we know the strengths and weaknesses of that from our other experience in other languages, and those same strengths and weaknesses here. And then dependency injection and service locator are another way, and we know their strengths and weaknesses. The cool thing is that there are libraries available to you to help you do that in the JavaScript world, just as there are libraries for doing that in C# and Java and VB. They're there, but you got to start bringing those kinds of, that kind of thinking, those concepts suddenly become JavaScript core concepts.
It's kind of interesting that, I mean, I think a lot of the push for that, like there was people used to just kind of hack and get by in browser coding using JavaScript. And then, you know, it got so that it was, you know, there were better practices, but still you could kind of get by, honestly. I mean, I saw some code and you're like, how could this work? But it does. but then I think CommonJS is where you really kind of, like, JavaScript on the server is where you really kind of just have to write kind of better architected code, right? I mean, it seemed like that was really when I started seeing it just being like, yes, I'm actually going to unit test my JavaScript code, and I'm going to, like, I have to. I can't get by with just slapping it together anymore. Do you think that was way after?
No. That was, I agree with you. That was way before. That was when people said, you know what, this code is going to live for a long time. I can't just refresh the page and start over, which is the luxury you have in a browser. Now you're saying this code's going to live for a while, and that gives it greater opportunity to collide with something that somebody else is doing and mess things up. So I think it started there. And then what happened is people started to write serious applications in the browser that live for a while. It all has to do with when the code lives for a period of time. Then they began to say, hey, you know what? Same problem here. Guess we better have some of that stuff.
Now, if all of this is intimidating and overwhelming, we said that you can't use jQuery to hide from JavaScript, but what about some of the bigger libraries, the higher end libraries? And the one that springs to mind, because we've been talking about it a lot, is Angular. Do you still need to really understand JavaScript to this depth in order to make good use of that?
Well, yes. The answer is yes. You can't escape it. What it can do, what it brings is the machinery that you need to be able to move forward in a safe and consistent manner.
So there's no free lunch.
No, but it's a language like any other. I mean, one of the great things about JavaScript, the good parts, you know, there's these, they always show here's the whole manual of JavaScript, and it's enormous. And the JavaScript, the good parts, is like, what, 100 pages or something like that? Because with that thing, that's small enough to chew on. You get all the warnings you need. And then it's a digestible language, and I think you can move pretty far with that. Now, you know, Elijah, that's been around for a long time. Do you still consider that to be a pretty good baseline for a JavaScript developer?
Yeah, definitely. I would. That was one of the first books I read that opened my mind to, like, oh, I should be writing this a lot differently than I was. And so it was kind of an eye opener. It is a very short read, just, you know, 100 or so pages. But that was the big gap. That kind of what springboarded me from writing my JavaScript like I did C#. That really opened my eyes, and I wrote completely different after that. And I was like, oh, I could actually treat this as a language. And some of the things I thought were weird and frustrating became very clear. Like, oh, well, that's no wonder that was weird. But yeah, I liked what you said about testing and unit testing. And when Node kind of came, it seemed like that was a more popular thing to do. And even today, it seems like testing in the front end, not as many developers that probably should are doing it. But it is very important, because it's still a tricky business, because you have all these browsers and it's just a really mess. But it is a very important thing to do. The tool I tend to use these days, I used Mocha for a while because I liked the async syntax, but now Jasmine 2.0 has the same nice async syntax. So I tend to use Jasmine because it seems like it's integrated into more systems that I use. But I'll use Grunt to automate my Jasmine tests and just have them run as soon as it finds anything that I've changed. Is that what you tend to use, Ward, or use something else?
Yeah, I was using QUnit, but now I'm pretty much going with Jasmine because it seems to have the broadest appeal, and frankly, I like the way it modularizes your tests, which is something the QUnit can't do. And now that it has async, I agree. Skip Jasmine 1.0, go right to 2.0 and get on board. The thing I'm curious about, Elijah, is what do you use for a test runner? Jasmine prescribes how you write tests, but it doesn't, and it comes with a test runner, but I hear there are others out there. What are you favoring these days?
Well, I tend to, as I'm developing it, I use Grunt primarily to run my tests with Phantom.js. Now, of course, that's only WebKit, so you're not getting it, you know, all the goodness for different browsers like IE and Firefox and Opera. But it's a good kind of sanity check to make sure at least, is it mostly working? As I'm making them, I usually have the browser open as well and use Live Reload to just use the standard Jasmine runner. Just because if I run into a problem, then I'll kind of debug it through the browser while it's in the browser. Because, you know, it's hard to debug the output window on Node. So that's kind of I have Live Reload set up on my browser as well. So anytime I change my source code and press save, my browser will automatically refresh and my Grunt tool will notice I did it and it'll run in WebKit. And so I could actually have two. I could have a different browser other than WebKit. You know, I could have IE open or Firefox in order to refresh and have the WebKit version. So that's kind of my flow right now. I know there are other tools that, you know, you could actually have tons of different browsers all update at one time, but I haven't really done that yet. Does Karma do that, Ward?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, Karma will run those other browsers, but I think you're bringing up a really interesting point, and this speaks again to JavaScript concepts, which is you can get yourself wrapped around the browser axle really quickly, and I think of that as something to worry about later. If I'm writing a lot of JavaScript code, I'm trying to write as much of it as I can so that it is independent of the HTML. And there, it's just JavaScript, and there's a pretty good chance that JavaScript engines are going to be the same across most of the browsers I'm facing, rather than, you know, even if there are other things that are wildly different. So I can just have a selection of tests, just like you write unit tests, and then you know your integration tests are going to be really complicated. So it is here. You try and structure your code so you can spend a lot of the testing time not thinking about what browser to run against. You just structured your code so that it can be tested without having much browser involvement. And that's a really great practice.